Accession number 26561, reel 12.
Wing Commander Bernard, reel 12. You were telling us of this escape attempt at Bath, Stalag Luft 1, by Flight Lieutenant Peter Butterworth, I think it was.
No, he was a Lieutenant Commander in the Fleet Air Arm.
Was he? I think I got the name wrong. Lieutenant Commander Peter Butterworth. And you were describing his disguise, and then you were going to go on.
It was very well done. It was, being a theatrical man by hobby. He knew how to dress like a German and look like a German guard in homemade uniforms. It was not difficult. They were usually these uniforms were bleached. Where they got the bleach from, I don't know. But they were bleached pajamas to look like the white or off-white working uniforms that the Germans used. And they got down and they went round and they went to their own area by their own huts and so on, and the canteen, and it was most unfortunate that it was one of the guards' birthdays, and it was rather interesting that these soldiers gave little bunches of flour to each other on the birthday, which we thought was rather funny. And this man whose birthday it was said, "Everybody into the canteen and the beer's on me." And it was then that Peter Butterworth had discovered he couldn't proceed any further, so he had to be... they just recognised that he wasn't one of them. And they put him in the cooler, and the bars for this cooler were on the outside held with nuts and bolts with holes at either end of the bars, and he used his fork and spoon as a sort of grip and undid all the bolts on these and got out again. So to see him acting on the film, the Carry On series, you wouldn't recognise what a hero he really was.
Now, it just comes to mind, having looked at your notes again, there's a couple of other stories we haven't covered of your time. One is when you attempted to steal some coal. Can you tell us story? Because that's quite a
fun one, yeah. In this hut in Block 3, there was only three huts in Stalag Luft 1 in the NCO's compound, and even less in the officers. And it was very, very cold there. The up on the Baltic, you get a lot of frost for very low temperatures, and it was terribly cold. With the ice on inside the hut was abominable, and the coal rationing was one small briquette per man per week, and which wasn't enough to keep warm by any means. And we were shivering in our bunks with this dreadful piece of felt was called a blanket, would let the air in at the edges, and it wasn't at all comfortable. So Paddy Flynn, who was a Hurricane fighter pilot, was the only fighter pilot we had in the hut. Fighter pilots didn't normally finish up as prisoners of war at that time. And he looked round and he said, "Who's coming?" I'd only been shot down about a month then, and said, Who's coming with me to get some coal?" And not a soul did or said anything, and I thought, what an indolent lot. And I, being young and immature in prison ways, I said, "I'll come with you, Paddy." It was Paddy Flynn, an Irish pilot. And he said, "Right, what we do, Dave, we go across to the German cookhouse," and it was the cookhouse was diagonal across the one corner of the compound with a machine gun tower over it. And he said, "We'll get these iron barrows, wheelbarrows, and load them up with coal. And instead of going into the cookhouse with them, which the guard would expect, we cut off the edge side and raced back to our three huts, which were across the parade ground." And we loaded up, and Paddy said, right now. And we set off, and we hadn't gone very far before we were chased by a line of machine gun bullets. I didn't go for coal again. We managed to get the coal offloaded, threw the barrows back onto the parade ground, and hid the coal in many ways.
It was too risky.
It was too risky, yes. It wasn't worth getting a life, being shot for stealing.
Any other stories about Bath?
Yes. When the Canadians did a dummy run attempt on crossing the channel and landing, it was called the Dieppe Raid. We'd heard about this on our radio, our homemade radio, and all of a sudden, at an unusual time, they called for a roll call parade on three sides of a square, and Hauptmann Glimnitz, Pebble Lenz, officer in charge of the one of the officers in charge of the camp, came in his best uniform with a beautiful flowing cape with a giant eagle and swastika on the back of it. And through his pebble lens, he addressed the crowd and said, "Gentlemen, today your allies tried to invade Europe, but they failed." And a huge cheer went up. "Hooray!" And, "No, gentlemen, they failed. Hooray!" And he came to gloat about the victory over the Canadian attempt, and went back to have a look at his word book, his dictionary, to see if he got the word failed kaput sign 9. But we were very cruel to guards and people like that. Our favourite hobby was to drop a cigarette down their gun barrel over their shoulder and then tell them that their rifle was on fire. And all sorts of things like that.
Tell us more of it.
The fun side, yes. We determined to get our propaganda going, and there were giant blue bottle flies. Huge flies, almost as big as cockroaches came. And we got we captured some of these, quite a lot. And we got a piece of very fine cotton and a little bit of tissue paper, the shape of a drogue. And we wrote on the drogue, "Deutschland kaputt," and glued this assembly onto the back of the big blue bottle and launched them off. And they flew at a very slow speed, proclaiming that Deutschland was kaputt. There's a lot of nonsense like that. And the other interesting one was a lot of characters had been, who were married or had fiancés. And indeed, one of my close friends in the room, in the bed next to me, was sending a maximum amount of his pay that they would do to his fiancée. And this went on for three odd years. And then one day, he got a letter from her to say that I've got some lovely news for you. I got married, and that lovely money you sent me is fine for furnishing my house. But there were a lot like that. And the other strange one,
what they used to call Dear John letters.
That's right, yes. And the other famous one was the character, he had his fiance's photograph on a little homemade shelf alongside his bed, and with her photograph on. And another character came round one day and said, "What have you got my wife's photograph on your bed for?" He said, "That's my wife." And evidently she'd written him off on the first marriage and married again to this other character.
Bit of a coincidence.
Is that what they used to do, if they got these Dear John letters, they'd put them up on a notice board by the so-called cookhouse on the veranda, which led to the cookhouse, and that was a general, with the Germans' agreement, and that was all the social activities, any news that was able to be published was put up there, and these Dear John letters were invariably pinned there for the chaps to gain sympathy and the others to have a laugh.
Anything else happened at Bath before we move on?
I think yes, it was in the middle of a flax call, by the way. Flax call was right, which is contrary to the Geneva Convention. And the idea... Flak is an anti-aircraft thing. All the German Luftwaffe, they took over anything that involved any air. It didn't matter what it was. Parachutists were Luftwaffe. Anti-aircraft were Luftwaffe. I think it was a very good arrangement. Frequently we'd come back from a raid, and one of the most dangerous things of the lot was the British AK firing at us.
You've mentioned it. Yeah. So this was in the middle of an anti-aircraft battery?
Not immediately, it was adjacent to. You know, certainly if you bombed it, we'd have got some of the...
And how did that affect life?
Oh, it did, in so much as we were great ones, they'd... it would show off to the flak men, this is what you can do if you shoot properly. You can get prisoners like this, you see, as part of the propaganda. And whenever they marched past, they sang heartily German marching songs. And we learnt these, and we learnt to get them out of step. So as soon as they started singing, the Kriegers would line up along the wire and muddle them up by singing the same songs, but in just that bit out, and they all went out of step as a result of that. Another interesting thing there was when a new consignment arrived from being shot down, a new bunch of RAF prisoners, they would say, look, here they come. They've still got bacon and eggs in their bellies.
Anything else?
I think I've covered most.
So what about the move then? That was in June 1942, I think.
Yes, we heard of that, yes. Oh, yes, I've thought of one. Yes, they wanted to weed out a couple of escapees who'd been caught. They were going to be sent to another camp. And they assembled us in this German cookhouse. The whole camp was sent there, because we wouldn't give up these two characters. And we're in there, and they're saying, the Germans was haranguing us and saying, you must give him up, give them two men up. I think it was Ozzy Lascelles and this former head of the camp, the flight sergeant, who we weren't too keen on anyway. But we put him at the back of the crowds and sort of covered him in. We're all packed very tight together. And the Germans were saying, you must give these two men up to us. And we said, no, 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 no. And then they undid their revolver holsters and said, we're going to start shooting now. And the chaps at the front turned around and said, give him up, because they were in the front line for being shot.
What happened?
Yeah. Well, they gave him up in the end, and they were sent off to another camp. But the other thing, the evacuation of the thing, we went on in phases, and the parties were nominated by names. And when they did, two of the characters got under the floorboards of the camp, which were fairly well hidden in those days, unlike Steinlauf 3. Which you could see right through underneath, and they hid under the floorboards. And when the campers evacuated, they were still in the empty camp without guards, but they were caught escaping again. assembled and put into cattle wagons, up to 100 men. There wasn't enough room for them to have no toilet facilities in there, and no food, no parcels. And I'd been very clever. I heard about this, we're likely to move, and I'd built myself a hammock out of Red Cross string with a spreader at either end, and I put that in my sack because I knew we were going to have a rough time in cattle trucks. But there were rings in there. It was either for 8 horses or 20 men, I think, but they were 100 prisoners packed in there. Not enough room for everyone to lie down, which was very tiresome, and it'd be anything up to 3 days in a wagon like that. En route, I think one funny occasion was that at dusk the rations came out for the guards, but not the prisoners. And one of the German guards was going past with his rifle over his shoulder and his half a loaf of bread with a piece of cheese and a piece of meat on top of it. And as he passed the truck, a hand shot out and whipped his supper off him. And brewing up on the way, we were allowed out for toilet purposes, well, at the odd stop, and we'd race up the front to the engine and with our billy cans and tea, and get the engine driver for cigarettes to put hot water into our thing to brew tea from the water in the engine. It was very uncomfortable, very distressful things. I cut a hole in the floorboards to have a wee through, but it was still disgusting accommodation.
And this was for about 3 days?
Yes. I was shunted into sidings to make way for more important traffic to go through and so on.
Now what happened when you got to Sagan?
Got to Sagan, yes, and we went in. The first thing we did, this was a brand new, had been built by Russian prisoners, and the first thing we did was had a look at these brand new stoves and flip the fire bars, the door tensioning bars off. They were wonderful hammers, and if we wanted men's shoes or anything, we'd upturn a stool and put the shoe on the top the leg and use it as an anvil for repairing shoes.
Now tell me about the layout of the camp, because you were going into the NCO compound, weren't you?
East camp, yes.
And you were in the NCO?
Centre camp, it was called. The NCO is in centre camp, yes.
Centre camp, right.
Yes. There were a lot more huts there, and they were all to be filled later on.
And what were your impressions of Stalag Luft 3, the centre camp, when you first moved into the layout?
Well, the first thing we did was sized it up for escape activities.
How did you do that?
Well, just by, they were still pulling out stuff, pulling out the old trees, the stumps, and they had a most ingenious device. A sort of ratchet mower, very crude looking but very effective, was a piece of tree trunk was suspended, and there was sort of, in the same way as post office engineers climb up ladders with a horseshoe irons round their feet, and they used this system where they cranked a lever and moved the grappling iron up, and a chain pulled the roots up, and this tripod with another tree trunk in the middle and a lever alongside.
Now, this was a German device, wasn't
German
it?
Device, yes. And so it left a lot of empty holes where the tree stumps, so we were able to judge the calibre of the earth and what it was doing and how we'd tunnel through it. And if they'd left any tree trunks in, they'd help to bind the tunnelling structure.
Now, what hut were you in? Do you know the, do you remember the number?
Yes, I started off in hut 52.
Now, what was the hut like? I mean,
it wasn't the same compartments of little rooms that we'd had up in Bath. I say little rooms, but they'd house a small room would house 20 men at least.
That's at Bath. What about Hut 52? What was that?
Hut 52 was more spacious in some ways, but not, they were not individual huts. They were just one big hut divided into two, with groups of two and three core, three tier beds.
So it was just two rooms in essence?
Yes, two basic rooms. And the first thing we did was to get a pack of cards and decide which combine could have the corners, which were very desirable to keep the bunch together. They had a little.
Why were the corners best?
There were four corners, of course, to each of the two rooms, and this was done by drawing cards. And I remember one of our characters, who was a gas engineer, actually, Eric Galloway, and he said, "I'll do the cards," and they'd all go in a group round there, and they'd all draw the fires. And he said, "And when I draw the cards, and tell them how you will slip that black ace into the top of my hand, so that I will come up with the ace." And we said, "Well, what if you get caught? The others will slaughter you." He said, "Oh, we just laugh it off." But it was that sort of thing. Cards.
So why were the corners so good?
Well, the compactness. Otherwise, your combine was fragmented if you had a central. And the idea was, if you had your neat corner, you could keep it nice and clean, and the duties were done. And it had a little end room with a stove in it, which one was able to cook one's meal in if you had any food to cook.
And we've done a lot about prison life, but how did life differ at Sagan, or did it differ?
It developed more at Sagan because we were in there longer, of course, and the old team from Bath were the seasoned ones by then. They'd done 2 years at least as prisoners, so they knew the ropes and philosophy of prison life.
What would you say the philosophy of prison life was? You mentioned this before. Talk to me a bit about that.
I think the main word is tolerance. One had to, being compressed together as we were in a crowd, one had to be tolerant of anybody who was a nuisance. They weren't all perfect, of course, and some made themselves unpopular, but you had to tell them off in a nice way rather than the quarrels weren't. It was remarkable to me that we didn't quarrel. We had debates, yes, but they were properly organised debates, not personal quarrels.
But didn't the tension cause flare-ups and problems and arguments and fights?
Nothing like amongst the old prisoners. No, nothing like. They'd learned to look after. Yes, some of them looked after each other, and with the right one, I think. Classic occasion was this big tough knot. He was a bank guard, a very tough character, a fairly big one, and his companion, his chum, was a small, we called him Foxy, because he was small. He was an electrician and would do a lot of work in the theatre, and to on the stove, depended on the size of your combine, you would be allocated so many minutes per man per combine. And Jimmy House, his name was, this big tough guy, said, you know, it was his turn on the stove for Aberdeen. He didn't get much time because there were just two of them, and he cooked a meal, and the other character was arrived back an hour later than the prescribed time. And Jimmy House said to him, "Where the hell have you been?" He said, "I've had this meal cooking on. I've been pinching other people's time to keep this meal hot for you. Where have you been?" And this little fellow sat down in front of the meal. And he said, "What, stew again?" And Jimmy House just picked up the plate of potato and very limited stew out of Red Cross parcel, picked it up and ground it in his face. "Yes," he said, "stew again." And the other funny cooking one was the stewards would take turns to cook for the combine. And this particular character was very clueless. Somebody brought in from a working party, very few NCOs, very few airmen, and they were required to go out, and some of them brought back goodies that they would have got from the countryside or friendly Germans and so on. And they would would donate these or get them for cigarettes. And we had a load of beetroot come in and shove down the trousers of these workers. And we managed to procure some of these for our combine. And we sat down to the meal looking forward to some bully beef out of the Red Cross parcels and some beetroot to go with them. And when we looked down, there was no beetroot on the plate. I said, "Well, what have you done with the beetroot?" He says, "Oh, it's there." And there it was, all white. It was looked like potato, you see, cooked potato. But in fact, he'd peeled these wretched beetroots and lost all the red juice out of them. And on another occasion, he was not a very competent cook when it was his turn. He had a tin of pilchards, not only about four pilchards in a tin, and I think that was, if you got half a pilchard with your meal, you were very lucky. And he'd got these, and the Germans used to puncture these tins so that you couldn't save them for escape purposes. And this had been attempted pierce, but it didn't pierce actually. It was still fully sealed, but they had a little dent that looked like a hole, but it didn't go through the metal. And he put this on the stove to cook in its own tin, and there was a God Almighty bang, and the whole thing was splattered, and all these wretched pilchards were plastered all over the ceiling. He was not a popular cook. And although he wanted to turn as a stooge, he was called duty stooge, and his job was to cook and clean the fashion. It meant that everybody didn't have to do it, and it was all done in an orderly fashion and a routine, and you all took turns at it.